Timescape, Cassette 7.
Chapter 21, August 1998. By the time Marjorie heard a car crunch on the gravel of their driveway, she had everything ready. There was ice in the freezer, carefully hoarded through the power-off hours. She was looking forward to company after a dull week. John's description of Peterson had quite prepared her to dislike him. Council members were remote, forbidding figures. Having one in her own home carried the threat of committing some enormous social gaffe, and the compensating thrill of contact with someone more important than a Cambridge don. John had given her 2 hours' notice, the classic unthinking husband's trick. Luckily, the house was reasonably tidy, and anyway, men never noticed things like that. The problem was dinner. She felt that she would have to invite him to stay, out of politeness, though with any luck he would refuse. She had a roast in the battery-assisted freezer. She'd been saving it for a special occasion, but there was no time to defrost it. She knew it was important to put on a good show for Peterson. John was not inviting him home out of friendship. A soufflé, perhaps. She had searched through her kitchen cupboards and found a tin of shrimp. Yes, that would do it. A shrimp soufflé and a salad and French bread, followed by strawberries from the garden and cream. Bloody elegant, considering. It would exhaust a good fraction of her weekly grocery budget, but economy be damned on such short notice. She had fetched up a bottle of their expensive California Chablis and put it in the tiny freezer, the only way to chill it in time. Might as well make the occasion festive, she thought. For days she had hardly seen John, as he worked late every night at the lab. She got into the habit of fixing a quick and easy dinner for the kids and herself, keeping a pot of soup to heat up for John whenever he came home. Outside, car doors clapped. Marjorie stood up as the two men came into the living room. John looked his usual teddy bear self, she thought affectionately. Seeing him in daylight for the first time that week, she also noticed how tired he was. Peterson was good-looking in a smooth sort of way, Marjorie decided, but his mouth was too thin, making him look hard. "This is my wife, Marjorie," John was saying as she held out her hand to Peterson. Their eyes met as they shook hands. A sudden prickly feeling ran through her. Then he looked away again, and they moved into the room. "I hope this isn't inconveniencing you too much," Peterson said. "Your husband assured me it was all right, and we still have some business to discuss." "No, not at all. I'm glad to have some company for a change. It can be pretty dull being the wife of a physicist when he's working on an experiment." "I imagined it can." He gave her a brief dissecting glance and strolled over to the window. "You have a charming place here." "What can I get you to drink, Peterson?" John asked. "I'll take a whiskey and soda, please." "Yes, this is charming. I'm very fond of the country. Your roses look especially good." He gestured towards the garden and followed this up with precise comments on soil conditions. "You live in London, I suppose, Mr. Peterson?"
"Yes, I do."
"Thank you." He accepted a drink from John. "Have you got a weekend cottage in the country, too?" Marjorie asked. She thought she saw something flicker for a second in his eyes before he answered.
"No, unfortunately. I wish I did. But I probably wouldn't have time to use it. My work requires a lot of travel."
She nodded sympathetically and turned to her husband.
"I'm one ahead of you on the drinks, but I'd like another one, please, John," she said, holding out her glass.
"Sherry, is it?" From the deliberately light way he spoke, Marjorie saw at once the effort he was making to get on with Peterson. She had felt the tension between the two men from the first instant. John crossed to the sideboard and said in a strained, jolly voice,
"It's Ian's job to see we aren't forced to sop up too much of this stuff in order to face the world."
This remark made no visible impression whatever on Peterson, who murmured,
"Unfortunate that previous sots haven't the excuse of a world council to blame their reality avoiding on."
"Reality avoidance?" Marjorie broke in. "Isn't that the new therapy theory?"
"A disease masquerading as a cure, I'll wager," John chuckled.
Peterson confined himself to a "hmm," and turned towards Marjorie.
before he could change the subject, as he obviously intended. She said, in part to keep him off balance, "What's the reality behind these odd clouds we're seeing? I heard a bit on the news about a Frenchman saying they were a new type, something..."
"Can't say," Peterson said abruptly. "Can't really say. I get awfully behind, you know."
Marjorie thought, "Quite an artful dodger." "Yes."
"Brazil, then. What can the World Council tell us about that?"
"The bloom is spreading, and we're doing what we can."
Peterson seemed to warm to this subject, perhaps because it was already public.
"Is it out of your hands, then?" she asked.
"Largely. The Council identifies problems and directs research, integrating them with political considerations. We pounce on technology-related sore spots as soon as they become visible. Most of our function is integrating the satellite eco-profiles. We sift through the data for telltale changes. Once a supranational riddle appears, it's really up to the technical types to solve it,"
John finished, returning with the sherry.
"It's that putting-out-fire psychology that makes untangling a riddle so sodding hard, though, you see.
With no continuity in the research..."
"Oh, John, we've heard that speech before," Marjorie said with a gay lilt in her voice she didn't feel. "Surely Mr. Peterson knows your views by now."
"Right, I'll pack it in," John agreed mildly, as if remembering where he was. "Wanted to focus on the equipment thing anyway. I'm trying to convince Ian here to get on the phone and get me help from the Brookhaven people. It takes clout, as the Americans say, and more than I have, regrettably," Peterson broke in. "You have a mistaken notion of how much, or rather what kind of influence I have. The scientific types don't like council people moving them about like pawns."
Marjorie said, "I've noticed that myself."
John smiled fondly.
"No point in being a prima donna if you don't get in the occasional aria, is there?"
"But no," turning back to Peterson, "I merely meant that some of Brookhaven's advanced equipment would cut through our noise problem. If you..."
Peterson compressed his lips and said quickly,
"I'll press from this end. You know what that's like. Memos and committees and review panels and the like. Bar a miracle, it'll take weeks."
Marjorie put in loyally,
"But surely you can exert some..." "Markham's the one who can do that best," Peterson said, turning to her.
"I'll lay the groundwork by telephone. You can go and see the chaps in Washington and then Brookhaven."
"Yes," John murmured.
"Yes, that would do it.
Greg has connections, I think."
"He does?" Marjorie said doubtfully. "He seems, well..." Peterson smiled with amusement.
"A bit off, a bit in bad taste, a bit not quite the thing. But he's an American, remember?"
Marjorie laughed.
"Yes, isn't he? Jan seems much nicer."
"Predictable, you mean," John said.
"Is that what I mean?"
"I think," Peterson said, "that is what we usually intend. Doesn't rock the boat."
Marjorie was struck by the agreement between the two men. It had a certain wry, sad quality to it. She hesitated for a moment, as they both, almost as if on signal, stared into their glasses. Each tilted his glass, and ice cubes tinkled against the sides. The amber fluid swayed and turned. She looked up at the silent, hovering room. On the dining room table, the polished wood reflected the bouquet of flowers she had arranged, and the glossy vision of the vase seemed a cupped hand upholding the world. Had Peterson told John something earlier, some bit of news? She searched for a way to break the mood.
"John, more sherry?"
"Right," he said, and got up to fetch it.
He seemed vexed.
"What was that earlier in the car about the woman from Caltech?" he called to Peterson.
"Catherine Wickham," Peterson said with a flat voice. "She's the one working on those micro-universes."
"The papers you showed Markham?"
"Yes. If it explains your noise level, it's important."
"So that's what you put the call in about?"
John asked, pouring sherry.
"Like another?"
He held up the whiskey.
"Would, yes. I got through to her, and then Thorne, the fellow who's running that group. She's coming over on the next flight."
John stopped halfway through pouring.
"Well, you must have pushed the right buttons."
"I know Thorne's contract monitor."
"Oh," Pause. Quiet.
Well, let's not bore your wife by talking about business, Peterson said. I'd like to see your garden, if I may. I spend most of my time in London or travelling, and I must say it's delightful to see a real one-family home like this.
He glanced sideways at her as they got up. A deliberate play for her sympathy, she wondered.
Does your wife travel with you?
No, she doesn't.
No, I suppose she couldn't with her business. She must be doing very well with it.
Yes, I believe it's flourishing. Sarah usually does well with anything she undertakes.
His voice gave nothing away. Do you know his wife, Marjorie? John asked, puzzled.
They were out on the terrace at the head of the steps to the lawn. The sun was still high.
No, not personally, but I know of her. She used to be Lady Sarah Lindsay Stuart Buttle, you know.
John looked blank.
Oh, you wouldn't know. Anyway, she designs these marvellous little dresses now. Sarah Lindsay. You don't have any children, do you, Mr. Peterson?
No, I don't. They walked across the lawn. Somewhere off to the right, a cock crowed.
Your chickens? Peterson asked her. Yes, we keep half a dozen for eggs. Sometimes for eating, too, though I hate the killing the silly things.
What kind do you raise? Orpingtons or Leghorns? I suppose if they're mainly for eggs.
She looked at him in surprise. You know something about hens, then, do you?
Yes, we've got some Orpingtons. No Leghorns. They're good layers, but I like the brown-shelled eggs better than white.
Right. And Leghorns are highly strung, too. They tend to cause chaos in a small run, which is what I suppose you have. How about Rhode Island Reds? They lay nice brown eggs.
I've got a couple of pullets right now. They haven't started laying yet.
You're going to crossbreed, are you? That rooster didn't sound like a Rhode Island Red.
I'm surprised you know so much about them.
He smiled at her. I know a lot of things that surprise people.
She smiled back politely, but tried to keep her eyes cold. She was one woman who was not so easily charmed. The man was despicable, she told herself. He had no interest in her at all. He automatically flirted with her just because she was a woman.
Would you care to have dinner with us this evening, Mr. Peterson? She asked rather formally.
That's very kind of you, Mrs. Renfrew. Thank you, but I already have a dinner engagement. As a matter of fact, he added, looking at his watch, I should probably be going. I'm supposed to meet someone at 7:30 back in Cambridge.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to go back to work this evening, too, John said.
Oh, no, she protested. It's too bad of you.
She was feeling rather tipsy now, and in the mood for company. She also felt full of energy, almost twitchy, as if she'd drunk too much coffee.
I haven't seen anything of you for ages, and I was going to make a shrimp souffle for dinner. I absolutely refuse to be left alone again this evening.
Sounds like a tempting offer. I wouldn't hesitate for a moment if I were you, John,
Peterson said with another of his insinuating smiles. John looked embarrassed at her outburst before a stranger.
Well, all right, if it's that important, I'll stay for dinner. I'll probably have to go in for a couple of hours afterwards.
They went back into the house. Peterson put his glass down.
Thank you for the drink. I'll let you know when I next have to go to California.
Mrs. Renfrew,
thank you for this pleasant interlude.
She let John see him to the door, and she got herself another drink while they were in the hall. It was rather disappointing that Peterson was not staying to dinner. She might even have enjoyed a mild flirtation with him, although he was, she supposed, a totally unprincipled and unlikable character.
John came back into the room, rubbing his hands. Well, that gets rid of him. I'm glad he couldn't stay, aren't you?
What did you think of him?
Reptilian, she said promptly. Smooth and slimy. I wouldn't trust him an inch.
Of course, he's very attractive.
Is he? He looks pretty ordinary to me. I was surprised that you knew all that about his wife. You never mentioned it before.
Oh, but heavens, John, it all came back to me while he was here. Don't you remember? There was that frightful scandal about her and Prince Andrew. Let me see. I was 25, so it must have been 1985. Prince Andrew's the same age as me, and she was, oh, I don't know, about 30, I should think. Anyway, I can remember how we all talked about it. Randy Andy, we called him.
I don't remember it at all.
Oh, but you must. It was in all the papers. Not just the gossip columns, either. Lots of letters about the public expecting higher standards of the royal family and all that stuff. And the Queen had Peterson made an ambassador to, well, I don't remember where, but it was a long way off. Africa.
You mean they were married then?
Well, of course they were. That's what made it such a scandal. They had a big society wedding only about a year before that. He wasn't actually made an ambassador. You know, first secretary or some such post. Yes, we used to think Prince Andrew was rather super. It's quite an exciting affair. I think the last straw was when they got a bit smashed one evening and he took her back to a room in Buckingham Palace and hung a Do Not Disturb sign on the door, a sign they'd pinched from some hotel. And then she told the reporters when the story got out that she'd always wanted to do it in the palace, but the beds were hard and lumpy.
Good heavens, Marjorie.
She giggled at his expression. Well, it is rather funny when you come to think of it.
She sounds completely irresponsible. It's almost enough to make me feel sorry for Peterson, although I dare say they deserve each other. I suppose he only stayed with her because she could further his career.
Very probably. I must say I didn't care for him at all.
Now that she had said it, that seemed right. It helped explain some of the odd tension and confusion. He seemed interesting, but perhaps that was due to the three drinks.
Well, I'll get that souffle into the oven. Could you set the table, love?
Yes, he murmured, absent-mindedly moving across the room. Thought we could catch the news, too.
Marjorie turned back. News? That's it. You and Peterson had this funny moment earlier. What were you thinking of?
John stopped. Oh, yes. He had the same look on his face this afternoon when he got a telephone call at the lab. It reminded me. I overheard part...
He paused, thinking.
Well, Marjorie said severely,
what about?
The clouds. A report on their composition. And when he sidestepped your question, I knew something was up.
Do you think the news will have anything?
If Peterson's keeping mum, I doubt it. Still,
the children had been watching ITV. John switched it back to BBC One. Marjorie stood in the doorway watching. There was only one major news broadcast each day. The rest was entertainment, mostly situation comedies with the occasional Western and old movie. Few wanted to see anything serious these days.
Rioting in London, too, today, although there were no casualties. Cornish protest groups demonstrating in Trafalgar Square became involved in a scuffle with the police. A police spokesman says the group ignored an injunction to clear the streets and let traffic proceed, so the authorities were obliged to dispel the gathering by force and arrest those who resisted. Hugh Caradoc, leader of the Cornish Movement for Independence, claims that the demonstration was an orderly one and that the police attacked without provocation. The screen showed a wild-eyed man with one fist upraised being dragged away by two policemen. The announcer paused again and looked more cheerful. Preparations for the coronation are going forward. The King and Queen visited Westminster Abbey today and were received by the Right Reverend Gerald Hawker, Dean of the Abbey. They remained for a little under an hour. The familiar facade of Westminster Abbey appeared on the screen, and dwarfed by the portals, a couple emerged, waved briefly to some bystanders, and ducked into a waiting limousine with the royal standard fluttering over it. Invitations for the November ceremony have now been sent out to heads of state all over the world. At the Royal Mews, work has started on refurbishing the state coach, traditionally used for coronations. It is to be entirely regilded at an estimated cost of £500,000. Mr. Alan Harmon, MP for Huddersfield, said in the House of Commons today that it was an outrageous burden on the British taxpayer. A palace communique today confirmed that 14-year-old Prince David is suffering from chickenpox and is in isolation at Gordonston School. The heir to the throne is reported to be whiling away his time reading science fiction comic books. And now for the sports news of the day. At the close of play, Kent were all out for 245 in their match against Surrey.
Marjorie left the room to prepare the dinner. John Renfrew remained in front of the TV set, waiting for the Yorkshire score. He never had time for sports anymore, but he still followed the county cricket matches and the tests and supported Yorkshire. In the kitchen, Marjorie bustled about.
She felt jittery. Dull old cricket. Why did he sit there and watch that stuff? He could be helping her, or at least talking to her, since he was planning to go out again. She wondered about the wine, and decided against it. It was a waste to drink it when she was going to spend the evening alone, and she felt light-headed anyway. She tossed the salad, got out bread and butter. The souffle was just ready. She went back to the living room. John was still in front of the television. "I thought you were going to set the table then," she said sharply. He looked up vaguely. "Oh, is dinner ready? I'll do it in just a minute." "No, not in just a minute. The souffle's done and it won't wait. Johnny will do it now." She flounced out of the room, and he stared after her in surprise. He ambled over to the sideboard and pulled out some forks and mats and put them on the table. Marjorie came back with the souffle. "Do you call that setting the table? Where are the napkins? And the glasses? And call the children, too. I'm going to serve this before it falls." She sat down at the table. "What's the matter, love?" he asked innocently. "What do you mean, matter? Nothing's the matter," she snapped back. "You sound cross," he ventured. "Well, it's jolly irritating. All I ask you to do is set the table and I get everything else ready and then find you haven't done a thing. I'm fed up with working hard all day, and what's the point of it? I clean the house and we never entertain anymore, so no one sees it anyway. I make a nice dinner and you just eat and run. I might as well have opened a tin of baked beans for all you notice. And I'm sick of spending the evening alone and half the night for that matter." She rose to her feet, confronting him. "Marjorie, I'm sorry, my dear. I hadn't realized. Look, I'll stay home tonight if you feel that strongly about it. I thought... I mean, I know I've neglected you of late, but this work means an awful lot to me. It's vitally important, Marjorie, but I couldn't do it without knowing you're there behind me. You're the most stable element in my life. I don't tell you so because I take it for granted that you know it. I just count on you. I couldn't concentrate on my work at all if I knew anything were wrong with you." She smiled wryly. "Now you're making me feel guilty. I've let you down, haven't I? You want me to keep the home fires burning, be your support system, behind every great man, and so on and so forth. Well, mostly I'm happy to do it, but this evening I feel a little selfish. It's not just your being out all the time. It's been a long, hard day, one thing after another. I had to queue up for hours. They were out of meat everywhere. I can't get anyone to come and fix the loo for a whole bloody fortnight, and someone broke the lock on the garage today and stole a bunch of tools." "They did? You didn't tell me." "You gave me no chance. I can never reach you at the bloody lab. And Nicky came home from school in tears because Miss Crenshaw, of all people, has up and gone after Tristan da Cunha with no notice or anything. And you know how devoted Nicky was to her. I thought the government was going to stop emigration of needed workers. I suppose Miss C didn't qualify as needed. Anyway, I had to console Nicky, and then you phoned and said you were bringing Peterson home. Honestly, sometimes I feel just like a football for other people to kick around."
"Why don't you take a day off?
Go into London shopping. Buy yourself a dress. Go to the theatre. Alone? You choose the day, and I promise I'll come up in the evening and meet you for the play. How about that? So long as it's not one of those new-style gloom-and-doom pieces. The world's in bad enough shape already without that." She laughed, mollified. "Oh, things are not as bad as everyone makes out. The world's been through worse times. Think of the Black Death or the Second World War. We'll survive all this, too. Yes, I think a day in London is a good idea. I haven't bought any new clothes for ages. Oh, John, I feel a lot better now. And you know, you don't really have to stay this evening. I know you're dying to get back to your work."
"I'll stay," he said firmly. "Tell me more about what was taken from the garage. You know, it's high time we had an alarm system installed. You think it was those squatters up at the old farm?"
"Oh, my God, John," she wailed suddenly. "Look at the souffle. It's as flat as a pancake." She sat down heavily and stared at it. Then she started to laugh. Her laughter merged gradually into sobbing. John stood behind her, patting her shoulder awkwardly.
"Don't take on so, love," he kept saying.
Finally, she dried her eyes and sat up. "Well, I'm not hungry anymore, anyway.
I don't want to eat the beastly thing. I'm exhausted. But the kids haven't had dinner. I suppose I have to get them something.
She started to get up, but John pushed her back into her seat.
No, you don't. I'll open a tin of soup for them or something. You go off to bed. You look all in. Don't worry about a thing. I'm staying home this evening and I'll take care of everything.
Thanks, John. You're a dear. Yes, I really think I will go to bed.
She watched him go into the kitchen and stood up wearily. Then she almost started to laugh again. Just an hour or two ago, she'd been feeling starved of sex because John was so seldom home. Now he was home for the evening, and she was so tired she could hardly keep her eyes open long enough to get to bed. Bloody marvellous, wasn't it?
Chapter 22. She appeared on time at their agreed-upon meeting place, the low stone wall in front of King's. Peterson hesitated for only an instant, rummaging for the phrase that would call up her name. Ah, yes. Laura at Bowes.
Hope I haven't kept you waiting, she said, smoothing her dress with dainty hands.
He murmured something in automatic reply, struck again by how pretty she was. He noticed with amusement that she was wearing a simple dress that was a copy of one of Sarah's models. A good copy. It would have fooled almost anyone. Laura was impressed with the car, a late model, custom modified for him. She looked wonderingly at the bossed wood and understated dash, yet said nothing.
Trying to appear blasé, he judged. Even Sarah, who must have been sophisticated at age 5, had exclaimed over the interior. Come to think of it, the only person he could recall who had not been impressed was Renfrew. He wondered what that meant.
When they entered the restaurant, some miles outside Cambridge, the head waiter apparently recognized him. The other male diners didn't. It was Laura who drew the stares. Gin and tonics, opulent linen napkins, the usual. Laura looked round the room in a way suggesting that she was taking mental notes for her friends. Impressive, he supposed, but stylistically a hodgepodge. Basically an English country inn with touches of French elegance that didn't fit. The chintz, the large stone fireplace filled now with plants for the summer, the beam ceiling, the low, round oak tables. All were comfortably familiar, solid. The chandeliers and tinted mirrors were wrong. Doubly so, for the flat-plate TV, giving a not-quite-right view of a French courtyard with distant moving figures in the fields, farmers apparently gathering hay, and the fake Louis XV half-round side table with its bowed gilt legs was simply a monstrosity.
"Franges?" Laura exclaimed.
"Yes," he said. She remarked very precisely,
"I wonder what the Rognon de Veau Flambé is like, and the Côte d'Agneau à l'ail."
"The first, probably so-so. They're big on flaming here. The second, more likely adolescent mutton than real lamb. Your French is quite good."
"Might as well get that in." He phrased a longer compliment in French.
"Sorry, I only speak food."
He laughed, pleased to find a touch of wit in her. They discussed shoplifting in Bows and Bows. Peterson had deflected most of her questions about council matters.
"Why not a guard at the door searching briefcases?" he asked.
"Mr. Smythe wants ours to remain a gentleman's establishment, where the customers don't feel they're under suspicion."
Peterson recalled a time when one could count on having rooms in a college, and was given sherry when one went round to one's tutor, and wore a white dinner jacket for the May balls. Now all the colleges admitted women, and women shared rooms with men if they liked, and there was even an all-gay college, and academic gowns weren't required anywhere. She went on about how rude the students were today. He nodded, guessing that this was the sort of thing she expected he would like to hear. Not far wrong, actually, but it was her charm that interested him, not her opinions. He brought his mind to bear on the situation. It seemed like a straightforward problem in the timeless sexual game. Perhaps it was the predictability of it that explained his inattention to detail. He had to force himself to follow the thread of her talk. She wanted to get into films or maybe acting. Check.
A flat in London if she could find some way to move.
Right.
Cambridge was dull, unless you liked the dreadful academic sort of amusements. She felt something really did need fixing in the current political situation, but had no suggestions as to what that might be. No surprises. But she was awfully pretty, and had a graceful way of moving. She accepted all of the vegetables that arrived in silver dishes, each in its own sauce. Probably didn't get much variety at home, particularly since the French crop failures. He speculated for a moment about whether the council should have stepped in on that one, ruling out the new techniques, and then pushed the subject back into place. No point in dwelling on past issues. Since he was having trouble focusing, he began directing the flow of talk. It was easy enough to work in a recent state function, slide a few names past at the right speed to be understood, but not so slowly that she would suspect he was dropping them in deliberately. Then he slipped in a reference to Charles, and she blurted, "Do you really know the King?" Actually, he was on respectful and professional terms with Charles, but he had no hesitation in exaggerating the relationship as far as believable. He felt confident that she didn't even notice the discreet gesture with which he ordered another half bottle from the wine waiter. She was getting slightly giggly now. He took advantage of it to try rather more risque stories on her. At one point, she covered her glass with her hand, protesting that she'd had enough. He set the bottle down and started to tell her the salacious details behind the Duke of Shropshire's recent divorce. He quickly got to the scene in court when the famous headless photo was produced. Lady Pringle had sworn it was the Duke. She would recognize him anywhere. The judge had asked to see the photo. He found it to be essentially a close-up of a man's genitalia, though his companion's face was clearly identifiable. Laura was giggling now so helplessly that he felt sure she didn't see him refill her glass. As he went on with how the judge had asked Lady Pringle how she could be so sure it was the Duke, he raised his glass and Laura imitated him unthinkingly. He let her swallow her wine before he told her Lady Pringle's reply, which had so convulsed the court that the judge had had to order it cleared. He sat back and watched her. Things were going splendidly. She had abandoned her affected flirtatious attitude and momentarily her refined accent. "Oh, go on with you," she said, her vowels sliding obliquely through a range of East Anglian diphthongs. The waiter had pushed a trolley of sickeningly elaborate French pastries to their table. As he expected, she chose the creamiest and attacked it with the unabashed eagerness of a schoolgirl. Over coffee, she became earnest again, watching her vowels and pressing him about politics. She repeated the common newspaper cant about irresponsible corporations pushing questionable new products into the world without a thought for social impact. Peterson resigned himself to sitting through this standard lecture, and then, without quite realizing it, found himself thinking aloud about matters he had shelved for a long time. No, you've got it wrong, he said suddenly. The wrong turning came when we started going for the socially relevant research in the first place. We accepted the idea that science was like other areas, where you make a product and the whole thing can be run from the top down.
Well, surely it can, Laura said, if the right people are at the top.
There are no right people, he said with energy. That's what I'm just now learning. See, we went to the senior scientists and asked them to pick the most promising fields. Then we supported those and cut the rest to focus our efforts. But the real diversity in science comes from below, not from innovative managers above. We narrowed the compass of science until nobody saw anything but the approved problems, the conventional wisdom. To save money, we stifled imagination and verve. It seems to me that what we have is too much science. Too much applied work without really understanding it, yes. Without pursuing the basics, you get a generation of technicians. That's what we have now.
More checking to see the unforeseen side effects.
To see, you must have vision, he said earnestly. I'm just beginning to catch on to that fact. All this talk of bloody, socially relevant work assumes a bureaucrat somewhere is the best judge of what's useful. So now the problems are outstripping the can-do types, the folks with limited horizons, and...
He stopped, puzzled with himself at this outburst.
It had altered the carefully cultivated tone of the evening. Perhaps fatally. Maybe spending the day with Renfrew had done it. For a moment there, he had been arguing fervently against the very point of view that had brought him so rapidly to the top. He took a long pull of coffee and chuckled warmly. I rather got off the beam on that one, didn't I? Must be the wine. Properly played, the momentary outburst could be used to show that he was passionate about the world, involved, independent thinker, etc., all of which might well appeal. He set to work ensuring that they did. The moon was high above the trees. An owl swooped silently across the patch of sky above the clearing. Cautiously, he slid his arm out from under her head and looked at his watch. Past midnight. God damn. He stood up and started dressing. She lay still, sprawled quite unself-consciously, legs flung wide as he had left her. She was lying on his jacket. He stooped to retrieve it, and in the moonlight saw tears on her cheeks. Oh, shit. Surely he wasn't going to have to cope with that, too. "Better put your clothes on," he said. "It's getting late." She sat up and fumbled with her dress.
"Ian,"
she began in a small voice.
"That's never happened to me before."
"Come on," he said, not believing her. "You can't tell me you were a virgin."
I didn't mean that.
He searched for her meaning.
"You never... Not with a man, not like that. I never had..."
She stumbled over her words, trailing off, embarrassed. So that was it. He didn't help her out. He felt weary and impatient, unmoved by her implied compliment. It was a point of honour to satisfy them, no more. God knows, she had taken long enough over it. Still, it had been a better job than that Japanese nymphomaniac in La Jolla, Kiefer's wife. There was now an unpleasant twinge when he thought of her. He had done the usual, indeed more. She had come again and again, and seemed insatiable. There had been a kind of feverish clutching to her, a thing he had noticed in many women lately. But that was their problem, not his. He sighed and pushed away the memory. He shook out his jacket, brushing away blades of grass. She was silent now, still fiddling with the tie on her dress, probably trying to make it into the same bow she'd left home with. He led the way from the clearing, empty of any further desire to touch her. When she slipped a hand into his, he thought it polite to let it stay there. He would be coming to Cambridge again after all. Absent-mindedly, he scratched a midge bite on his neck that he collected while tussling in the grass. Tomorrow was going to be another long one. He flexed his shoulders. A cold ache had settled into the muscles at the base of his neck. Let's see. There was the subcommittee meeting tomorrow, and some backup reading on the sacred car war still sputtering along in India. He realized with a start that he was living slightly in the future these days, as an ingrained habit. At Renfrew's, he'd been distracted by thoughts of dinner and wine. At the restaurant, he had watched Laura's hair and thought how it might look fanned out across a crisp white pillow. Then, immediately after the act, his mind had drifted on to the next day and what he had to do. Christ. A donkey, driven by the carrot. He was faintly surprised when they emerged from the damp woods into the moonlight, and he remembered that he was still in Cambridge. Chapter 23. Gregory Markham was surprised when Ian Peterson appeared in the laboratory, striding purposefully down the lanes of electronic gear. After the usual greeting, Greg said, "I would have imagined you didn't have much time these days for secondary efforts like this." Peterson looked around the bay. "I was in the neighbourhood. I saw Renfrew a few days ago and have been busy since. I wanted to talk to you and see this new Wickham woman." "Oh, about that. I don't see the necessity of my going stateside right away. There's..." Peterson's face hardened. "I've cleared your way with NSF and Brookhaven. I've done all I can from my end. I should think you'd no objection to running interference for Renfrew back there."
Well, I don't, but good. I'll expect you on the flight tomorrow as planned. I've got a lot of interesting theory to go over here. Things Kathy brought. Take it with you. Markham sighed.
Peterson was not the easygoing breed of administrator popular in the U.S., open to suggestion, even after a decision had been made.
Well, it'll hold things up, but where's Wickham?
Down that way. She came in yesterday, and John's still showing her around. A slim, rather bony woman approached.
Just finished the tour, she said to Markham. Pretty impressive. I haven't met you, I think,
she continued, turning her large brown eyes to Peterson.
No, but I know of you. Ian Peterson. So you're the guy who got me strong-armed out here? More or less. You're needed. I was needed in Pasadena, too, she said grimly. You must have lit a fire under some big honcho upstairs. I wanted to hear about these tachyons from sub-universes and so on.
My, you must be used to getting what you want pretty damn fast.
At times, Peterson murmured lightly.
Well, I've got the lowdown from Greg and John here, and I think that noise just might have, well, cosmological origins. Maybe micro-universes, maybe distant Seifert galaxies in our own universe. Hard to tell. Quasar cores can't produce this much noise, that's for sure. The data coming into Caltech and Kitt Peak seems to suggest there's a lot of dark matter in our own, enough to imply there are micro-universes, maybe.
Enough to close off our geometry, Greg put in. I mean above the critical density.
Could be. To Peterson, she added, if the density of dark matter is high enough, our universe will eventually collapse back in on itself. Cyclic cosmos and so on.
Then there's no way to avoid the noise in Renfrew's experiment? Peterson asked.
Probably not. It's a serious problem for John, who's trying to focus a beam in spite of all the spontaneous emission this tachyon noise causes. But it'll be no worry for 1963 or whatever. They're just receiving. That's a lot easier.
Peterson murmured a neutral conversation-breaking reply and said that he had to make some calls. He departed quickly, seeming rather distracted.
Funny guy, Kathy said.
Markham leaned against the computer console.
He's the man who opens the cash register. Humor him.
She smiled.
I'm amazed you got funding for all this.
A sweep of the arm. Her eyes moved, studying his face.
Do you really think you can change the past?
Markham said reflectively,
well, I think Renfrew started out simply to get funding. You know, a practical icing on a cake that's really fundamental and useless. He never expected it to work. I thought it was good physics, too, and we were both surprised at Peterson's interest. Now I'm coming to think that John was earnest from the first. Look, you've seen the equations. If an experiment doesn't produce a causal loop, it's allowed. That's open and shut.
This ends side one of cassette 7. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.